ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
So I woke up this morning and went through my regular routine. I opened the blind, made myself a cup of tea, and then returned to bed with my laptop. I scanned a couple of websites, then I checked out my Facebook feed.
Anthony, we care about you and the memories you share here. We thought you'd like to look back on this post from 6 years ago.
And what was the riveting, nostalgic memory that Facebook's algorithm served up to me? I kid you not, it was a photo I'd taken way back then, a photo of my brand new paper towel dispenser for the kitchen. Seriously, it's moments like those when you realise the true limits of algorithmic recommendation. AI, that's remarkably unintelligent. Hello, Anthony Fidel here. Facebook memories, more often than not, gets it wrong. At least, that's my experience. Its idea of what makes for nostalgia is like an elephant's idea of fine arts. But the social media giant persists in trying to curate our memories for us because nostalgia sells. When you get it right, that is. We begin this episode of Future Tense with author and critic Richard King, who's written an essay for the Griffith Review called Nostalgia on Demand. It's about the economics and politics of memory and the past. Now, the essay and this interview begin with Richard's take on, how should I describe it? Well, his take on a curious, newish online offering called Deep Nostalgia. Richard King.
Deep Nostalgia is an app on a website called MyHeritage.com, and it invites users of the website to upload photographs of their dearly departed, of people who are no longer with us. And what it does is to animate those photographs. So whereas a photograph ordinarily would freeze a moment in time and in so doing sort of attest the march of time and to the fact that someone is no longer there, what this appears to do is to sort of unfreeze time. And I used it myself with a photograph, a little unwisely, I think, looking back on it, of someone who I lost just recently. And the effect was very uncanny and unsettling.
It has almost a feeling of bringing people back from the dead, doesn't it? It's almost like it takes the deceased person's photo and in some ways brings them back to life for that very short period of time in video form.
It does, and that's what makes it so unsettling. And you have to wonder as well where that might be going when you think about the development of virtual reality and 3D camera mapping and that sort of thing. All memory is sort of mediated by technology, but this technology seemed to me to be manipulative in a way that other technologies aren't, or aren't consciously so anyway. A paradigm case, if you like, of where we're moving with regards to nostalgia more generally.
Nostalgia has always had commercial pulling power though, hasn't it? You know, that's why Unrequited Love has long been popular in movies and novels. You argue though, don't you, that nostalgia is beginning to take on a life of its own.
Yeah, that's right. I think it probably has always been pressed into service by the market. But I think it's interesting that I think that really begins to accelerate when we've entered an era of globalization and increased social atomization, I think. And what's happening when nostalgia is used within marketing or advertising is that really, in one sense, in a deep sense, perhaps not even consciously, we're being sort of compensated for the fact that we don't have perhaps that same grounded sense of connection that we had in the past. To put it baldly, it's almost as if we're being sold back the thing that's been taken from us. That's my sense of it. And the nostalgia cycle is tightening. So, we're invited to feel nostalgic for things that happened just a few years ago. It's absolutely everywhere. So you have applications like Facebook Memories and Time Hop and things like that that sort of remind you of an event that happened on that day in a year in the past or something. And you have an awful lot of fashion, an awful lot of stuff on TikTok that's very sort of marinated in nostalgia. the incredible efflorescence of prequels and reboots and things like, you know, sort of de-aging technologies even, I think, are sort of marbled into this phenomenon. And individually, they don't look like very much. They can seem quite innocuous and fun, but I think taken together, what we're looking at here is quite an interesting and quite a new cultural phenomenon.
Is that phenomenon, is it tied to the fact that almost everything we do, our communications, our sharing with friends, almost all of it is recorded in one way or another? So it's useful data, isn't it, for a commercial interest?
Absolutely. And that's the slightly sinister, or the potentially sinister aspect of this, the idea that one's memories are being manipulated in that way is, of course, an unsettling prospect. Nostalgia is a social emotion. You know, Fred Davis, who did a lot of work on nostalgia in the 1970s, made this point very strongly. And it's a mixture of sadness and warmth for a time that is distant or in the past, and sometimes idealized. So it's always slightly fictional. But it serves a psychosocial function, I think, in the prospect of that being manipulated or even counterfeited, fabricated almost, in a way that pulls that emotion or set of emotions into the sort of online reputational economy of likes and posts and retweets, et cetera, et cetera, is again quite an unsettling prospect.
And that psychosocial function that you mentioned, do you see that as a kind of coping mechanism? This is a very stressful time in which we live. Is our willingness to be nostalgic, is it a way of dealing with our fears for the future?
Yes, I think the literature seems to suggest that nostalgia is linked to times of crisis. It grounds us in a narrative that can orient us to the world, that makes us feel part of something, and in so doing protects us from those feelings of being exposed or indeed ungrounded. And the hunger for nostalgia that we're witnessing at the moment is indeed related to a broad, I mean, I said before that nostalgia is a social phenomenon. And I think the crisis that we're living through is a social crisis, or rather it's a crisis of sociality, if you like. We live in a much more atomized society, of course, than we would have done even in the recent past. And that's partly because of neoliberalism. It's partly because of the technologies that have entered our lives in the last decade or two. We now have an increasingly disembodied sociality. And I think that in itself is quite anxiety-making for a lot of people. And I think the hunger for nostalgia probably derives ultimately from that. But of course, the kind of nostalgia, or the kind of nostalgia-adjacent content that we're getting from these companies, isn't always the psychological nutrition that we need.
I want to just take you back to the relationship you talked about between nostalgia and neoliberalism and the market. Could I get you to unpack that a little bit more for us? What's the connection there? How does nostalgia serve the purposes of the market?
It's a paradoxical relationship, because the ethos of neoliberalism is really one of churn and of change. The idea is that individuals go out into the world and they make themselves. Sociologists talk about attained identities and ascribed identities, whereas in the past you might have had an ascribed identity linked to the place in which you were born, the class into which you were born, etc. Now you tend to have an attained identity. You make your own self, you make your own luck. That's the undergirding idea of it. What that brings with it is arguably some good things, but also a lack of sort of groundedness, a lack of feeling that you belong to a particular community. And it's in those situations that nostalgia becomes very important. It's therefore, in one sense, ironic that at the time neoliberalism is really getting going, advertising seems to become a lot more nostalgic. It gives us visions of those sort of remnant places of a sort of different dispensation. So some pasta sauce that's, you know, sort of concocted on some charmless industrial estate in Dublin suddenly becomes associated with a beautiful little village in Tuscany or something like that. Again, on its own, not particularly remarkable and even innocuous on the surface, but taken together, I think it's a very interesting change.
What does the future hold in a world where major technology companies now curate our memories and, you know, as we've been talking about, manipulate them at times, manipulate our feelings or our nostalgia?
Well, goodness knows what they're dreaming up in the San Francisco Bay Area. But, you know, if you look at the things to which the tech bros themselves are looking forward, you know, metaverses and all the rest of it, virtual reality, you have to say that this is only going to become more prominent as we move into the future. And who knows, we may be in a situation soon in which it's possible to visit with our dead, with old lovers.
A virtual form of them, you mean?
Yes, yes, a virtual form of them, that's right. And for those of us who are, to put it mildly, a little bit suspicious of this experience machine into which we appear to be moving, that's a worrying prospect.
Because experience is part of what is driving, well, it's an important driver, isn't it, of our commerce and our digital world these days.
It is, and there will be people all too ready to offer us the kinds of experiences that we can't get from our day-to-day lives. And I think that's the story, really, of what's going on. It's almost as if the market and technology within the market is giving us back the thing that, in certain regards, it has taken from us. And it's not just the market. There's a political aspect to this as well. It's, I think, no coincidence that the global debt crisis led to this rise in nationalism and populism, because what you have here is a sort of almost an invented sort of morbid form of nostalgia to which people can attach themselves in the absence of anything more authentic. The philosopher, the Polish philosopher Zygmunt Bauman, makes this point that the liberated self of neoliberal myth is in some senses related to what's happened with the whole drive towards populism since 2008.
And while you were saying that, I was thinking immediately of Make America Great Again.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one could not think of a more nostalgic or a more vacuous statement. I mean, it's true that, you know, even Reagan, you know, was sort of channeling the 1950s. But I think that's really where this kind of politics began in earnest, because what you get with neoliberalism, of course, is, broadly speaking, it was a little bit different in Australia, but broadly speaking, it was taken forward by nominally conservative parties. That seems very strange, because liberalism is a motor of change within history. Why would a conservative party bring that forward? There's a complex answer to that. But what you got was a sort of nuclear reactor model of society, with the market kind of bubbling away underneath, and then a sort of crusty carapace of traditional values on top. And in many ways, that's a decent metaphor for what's going on with the nostalgia industry, or algorithmic nostalgia, whatever we want to call it.
Richard King. And if you go to the Future Tense website, you'll find a link to his Griffith Review essay entitled Nostalgia on Demand: Streaming Memories in the Experience Machine. Perspectives on nostalgia and culture and our digital world. That's today's Future Tense. Now, when you go to our website, you'll also find an article from our next guest. His name is Jason Farrago. He's a critic at large for the New York Times, writing about art and culture. Jason calls for a new understanding of what we mean by culture, how we comprehend it, and he makes the provocative claim that ours could very well be the least innovative century for the arts in at least the last 500 years.
When we have spoken about culture over the last 100 years or so, we've always described it as something that is in progress, that changes over time. It's something that I think all of us have grown up with as such a fundamental understanding of culture that we almost don't even bother to put it into words. That when we listen to oldies stations, for example, or when we watch old movies, we can see obvious differences between then and now, and we see how history, or even just the times, were expressed in different ways at different moments. That is, however, at least in the West, a profound cultural moment, one that we call modernism. For a very long time, culture, in the broadest sense, I mean art, architecture, music, literature, theater, was not always understood by the people who created it or the people who saw it to be expressing something fundamental about their time. But something happened in the 19th century, something happened in which there was a real break from the past, and people understood that the classical tradition, the kind of things that you might see in a Greek temple, or the kind of poems that you might read from Greek and Roman tradition that were often seen as the sort of height of civilization, came from a bygone world. And people tried to express in the paintings that they made by somebody like Manet, or in the poetry they wrote by somebody like Baudelaire, something that was absolutely fundamental to their time. And generation after generation tried to do that. That's what we've all grown up understanding culture does. And my suspicion has been that time may be past.
So in that past time, there was, you point out, a novelty factor with culture. It was about striving to achieve something that was new, something that was different, that broke with past experience. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. For a long time, we used to believe that if an artist wanted to speak to their time, it wasn't just that they were going to tell a story about the time that we were all living through. It wasn't just that they were going to create characters that felt as if they had come from the time in which we were all living. It was that they were going to create new modes of narration, new styles of expression that rose to the challenge of speaking to the age in which they emerged. It's really pompous that people believed that that was the sort of project of art, to actually create some kind of brand new form of expression. Nevertheless, that's where the bar was for a long time. And for filmmakers, for composers, for theatrical directors, and certainly for novelists and for playwrights, there was this idea that one had to learn from the past. It's not as if the past didn't exist, but that there would be some kind of new form, a form that didn't exist yet. And your job as an artist, as a writer, was to make it new, as Ezra Pound put it. I think that we all sort of take that for granted. And I think one of the reasons that a lot of people may find culture currently to be, if not disappointing, then at the very least somewhat slower or more confusing than it was before, is because it doesn't seem to be producing those kind of step changes in style that the 20th century gave us so frequently.
In fact, you write about culture in the 21st century, in our time, as having a sense of directionlessness. And yet, we perhaps have more cultural institutions than ever before, don't we? And perpetual consumption drives the production of new experiences and artifacts. So how do we marry those two together?
It's a weird contradiction. You're right to bring it up. The audiences for culture are larger than ever. The amount of books that are being published, the amount of content that is getting emitted onto our social platforms is greater than ever. And you would think that given that the whole world is equidistant from the search bar, that there would be these efflorescences of new things, of unprecedented things, of surprising things. And what do we have instead? We have the very familiar phenomenon of sitting in front of the Netflix screen and scrolling and scrolling and having nothing to watch, of going onto Spotify and having one song sort of cut into the next, and you're not exactly sure who's singing or even when the new song comes from. I think one reason for that is because digital forms are fundamentally different from analog forms. It's not a matter of moral judgment. It's just a matter of the practical way in which we encounter these digital forms as things that are much more lightweight than, say, printed books or movies that you would go to see in the movie theater. You know, when we downloaded our first MP3s, for example, in the 1990s, there was something extraordinary about the idea that all the music of the past was somehow accessible to us. And yet at the same time, it was so lightweight, it was so unhooked from the institutions that gave music its meaning, whether that was the concert hall or the radio station or whatever it was, or the record store, that there was a sense that these things were just kind of afloat. And I have the sense that when people are sampling music now, or when people are making GIFs that come out of movies, there's a sense that these things are no longer grounded in their time in quite the same way as things were in the past. And in this kind of lazy river scroll of content, there has been a kind of unhooking from time. And artists, writers, are just like us. They encounter the forms of the past in the same way that we do, as a kind of floating, weightless phenomenon. And you can feel that in the kind of music that's being produced, where people are sampling songs from 10, 20 years ago now. And there's this sense that the entire culture of the 21st century, which is now 25 years old, a quarter of a century almost, doesn't have the kind of development over time in cultural terms. You listen to music from the 2000s or watch movies from the 2000s. They don't feel as foreign to us as things from the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. And yet, the kind of digital formats that we encounter them in on our screens and on our phones has changed profoundly. And that's the sort of contradiction that I've been so interested in as a critic, is how do we understand the fact that all of this culture is sort of flooding our feeds, and yet it seems to be rendering us incapable of finding new forms to emit onto these formats.
But have we given up then on trying to create something that is new, something that is different from the past?
I'm not sure that people have given up on creating things that are new so much as they keep trying in the wrong directions. I think that people have been frustrated with the fact that it was once quite easy, say if you were a filmmaker in Paris in the 1960s and you were a member of the French New Wave, and you suddenly had a new lightweight camera, you could pick it up and you could do something new. And you would have thought that the same thing might have happened with, say, cheap digital formats like the iPhone. It doesn't seem to have happened in quite the same way. And in fact, what I'm constantly amazed by is how all of these new technologies seem to actually be recreating the styles of the past. Everyone just wants to make a kind of new Star Wars or a new Spider-Man with their nifty digital tools. The question is, why do the books that are being published and the movies that are being made and songs that are being produced sound a little too similar to what came before, even if there's been this massive increase in the populations of people who are able to produce that? And I think one reason is simply that there's a nostalgia. There's a real nostalgia in all of us for a time when culture moved faster, a time when the music on our radios sounded totally different every 5 years.
Is a factor here the sheer amount of consumption that goes on? We've turned cultural artifacts into content, and we're consuming at an enormous rate. Is it no longer possible to innovate fast enough to meet our insatiable needs?
It's a good question. The fact is that, you know, culture in our time is principally understood through digital networks. And what are digital networks? They're information machines. They're machines that transmit ones and zeros across long distances and have to monetize that transmission in some way in order to keep the lights on. And so we have a system of cultural transmission that seems in many ways to be at odds with how we understood art to be created in the sort of high modernist period. We still have, for better and for worse, this sort of romantic understanding that an artist is somebody who's in a studio all alone against the white canvas and in some dark night of the soul creates something that is a true expression of his or her inner life. And only later in that process does the artist then go to market and try to find an audience for this creation. Now, of course, everything is in the other direction. Every creation is always already built into a system of transmission and monetization and informationalization that just negates, maybe negates is too strong a word, but certainly cuts the edges off the kind of innovation that we were all used to in the 20th century. And so this sort of endless profusion of cultural objects seems to ultimately obey, whether consciously or unconsciously, the demands of our social networks and of our transmission engines.
Does it follow then that we care less for modern cultural artifacts, that they're easier then to dispense with because they're not seen to be tied to the importance of our time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm sorry, this is a pessimistic thing for me to say as somebody who does love culture and cares about it very, very much. But there's an extraordinary thing going on in our lives in which television shows that are celebrated as if they are the new Dickens are forgotten 2 or 3 years later. And these series are spoken about as if they are sort of the equivalent of the sort of great novels of the Anna Karenina's and the Madame Bovary's of our time. And yet, you know, when was the last time somebody really spoke to you about The Wire? When was the last time somebody really spoke to you about, you know, Big Little Lies? These things seem to have substantially shorter half-lives than they used to. Pop songs seem no longer to be retro in the same way that they were before, but seem to just sort of disappear. There's someone who understands that, of course, very, very well, and that's Taylor Swift, who has done something very, very cunning and designated each of the sort of albums that she produces as an era, as something that has a kind of temporal component, and that she actually has to sort of perform time passing in her act and in her clothing and in her marketing in order to create the kind of endurance that we all used to take for granted in the past. But instead, sometime in the last decade, around 2015 or 2016, the market for older music overtook the market for new records for the first time ever. We actually have economic proof of this. And of course, musical estates, back catalogs, have become a really principal part of the music market. Intellectual property has become, of course, the hottest thing going in Hollywood. And there's a way in which the past has kind of devoured the future of culture. When you have these sort of double pressures upon you, one, the sort of lightweight nature of digital cultural consumption, and two, the omnipresence, the permanence of all of the great cultural achievements of the recent past, there's this sense that the new stuff just becomes kind of disposable or forgettable.
What are the implications then for the way in which our cultural time will be remembered in the future?
I think there's an optimistic and a pessimistic reading. The pessimistic reading is it's all over, right? That something went really wrong sometime around the mid-2000s, and everything is just a bunch of ones and zeros and beeps and boops, and the next decade's music and movies are going to sound just like this decade, so who cares if this decade's remembered? I have some dark nights where I wonder if that's the case. But most days I have a more optimistic reading. I think that the more optimistic reading is that we're actually entering a time that is not so unlike many, many centuries previously, in which artists and writers had a very different relationship to time. And that can be very, very exciting. You know, for a long time before the modern era, you could take an earlier painting and you could repaint it, or you could cut it down, or you could reframe it, because the initial work wasn't necessarily seen as being so anchored in a particular moment. And I think a lot of painters and a lot of artists who are working with digital forms are thinking in a similar way. I think that a lot of musicians, Bad Bunny is the classic example I always give, are recombining forms in ways that would feel very, very familiar to a pre-modern understanding of culture. And so possibly what our time is going to be remembered for, at least if things go well, is for a sort of great shift in how we speak about culture as something that isn't necessarily so anchored in year by year, decade by decade progressions, but becomes a sort of terrain of free recombination in which artists are finally liberated to make whatever they want to make out of all of the shards of the past and present. And in recombining them in some sort of novel is too strong a word, but at the very least engaging or surprising configurations, that is the way in which they can really speak to our time, into our great unstable digital 21st century. And in that way, I actually think this cultural moment might be incredibly exciting if, that is to say, our artists and our writers, but also our institutions, recognize the challenge before them and take it seriously.
Well, Jason Farrago, it's an absolutely fascinating topic. Thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Perspectives on nostalgia, culture, and our digital world. We heard today not only from Jason Farrago, but also from Richard King. My thanks as always to co-producer and co-creator Karin Zsivanovits. I'm Anthony Fennell. Cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.